When I think about people's attitudes towards risk from a board perspective, I find that there's some people, they just eat that stuff up. Brent's probably one of those. I suspect you're one of those too. And they just love it. And then there are people, and some of them are called CEOs, who just think, you know, it is just, they still want to deal with it. I think maybe 24 months ago, they were contemptuous about it. Now they just, you know, just would rather not deal with it. And then there's the vast majority of people that I know on boards, both public and private. They nod their heads and they smile and they go through the motions like, I know what they're talking about, but they don't know what they're talking about. And one of the things I really admire about Mike is that he takes complex issues and really makes it accessible. I really think that the value proposition that you give in your book and also your practices, you make the financial and the risk issues accessible. And I think that's a really good thing because not everybody on a board is qualified to be on an audit committee, but everybody on the board needs to understand risk. Mike comes from a financial services background. I think you saw his background on the email, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. There's some more information about Mike that he sent out. But for those of you who are interested, you know, do pick up a copy of Mike's book, The Risk Wise Investor. So I'm going to
thank you very much.
I could just put that here and put that here. That should do it.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I'd like to welcome you, and I'm very curious because the subject of risk isn't a fun subject. You know, it isn't about making tons of money or being hugely successful. It's about thinking about unpleasant kinds of things. And I'm curious, particularly with our subject tonight, what drew you to come tonight and maybe what you'd like to accomplish out of our few minutes together. Let's start with you.
Well, I always have this sort of equation. I think people who are entrepreneurs never think they're really taking a risk. And when I was constituting boards, I used to, among other things, in trying to get balance, get some of the guys who were belt suspenders and others who wanted to go out there. So I was interested in your input, Mike.
Well, terrific. Thank you.
I'd love to know what the board of BP thought.
When?
you know, the history of blowing it up, and yet they keep, you know, cutting the cost, and forgetting that at some point there's risk.
Now, we'll talk a little bit about that related issue a little later on. Hopefully we'll have the time. Yes, sir.
I just want to understand, in terms of risk is such a big term as large as an expert. So how do you really, at the board level, try to define it? What are the risks you focused on, whether it's the environment you are in, whether it's the business you are in, and how do you narrow it down from a really broad perspective of things that you want to deal with and be more practical?
Terrific. I think you're going to be happy because we're going to give you some ideas on how to do that and simplify it. Yes?
I go to school for finance and management. I'm very interested in investing and, you know, I want to see how risk plays into that.
Terrific. Hi, Brent.
To be perfectly candid, dealing with risk every day from an investment perspective, I'd be curious to hear your take on it, and I'm very interested in actually putting you in front of some of our wealthy clients and talking about the concepts of this.
Thank you.
Dealing in a number of financial applications, treasury, tax, legal, regulatory compliance issues on a regular basis, one of the problems I see is the lack of identification of risk issues. They're not identified early enough in the process. And they seem to be surprised us. And I'm interested in not just from a senior management perspective, how do you judge what potential risks could be on a short list, and then go through a triage process to flesh them out.
Very good. Actually, we'll talk a little bit about prioritizing risk during the course of our discussion, too.
Well, from my humble station in life, in the corp comm area, the marketing area, and the investor relations area, obviously we get a lot of these things when they don't go well, and then have to try to explain them. But on the positive side, when you look at the contributions that certainly in certain cases brands can make to valuation, can be as high as 25-30%. Obviously, this has major impact. Of course, one of the questions I plan to ask you tonight, so get ready, is not about BP, but HP. I'd like to go to that. They were about $6 billion in every valuation flush on that decision, and what a remarkable set of circumstances.
Yes.
To show, but.
Yes, sir.
Well, I guess to me, I mean, every decision in life is a risk reward. Financial or whatever. And I think Larry set out something, if it wasn't, I apologize, but somebody set out one of the internet questions about should boards have a risk committee on it. But I think my answer was yes. So it's just, it's really, if we're looking for the upside, we've got to protect against the downside. And what can a board member do to make that effective?
Very good.
I think I'm the entrepreneur that Paul mentioned. It's always taking on way too much risk. So now that I actually have some funds to invest, I ought to book in. How to do it wisely.
Taking it.
Years ago, I was on the nonprofit board, and fortunately, I got off after about 6 years, but it went under. And my fellow board members were very frightened of the attorney. And prior to that, I was always very cavalier about the fact I wanted to be on the corporate board. And then I became very concerned about the risk. And lately, even more concerned because I don't fully understand how that works. So I'm very interested in understanding more about it because I want to be on the corporate board, but I want to understand the present time.
Well, actually, we're going to talk a little bit about when you touched on really risk perception and the important roles that plays relative to risk reality and understanding the relationship of the two. It gives you actually a lot of power to kind of understand where you are in the continuum. Yes, sir.
My problem is different than most folks. I'm an entrepreneur, but I am too risk averse, and I always have to put it in a box. It's cost me a great deal of money. Although at times, like, it can pay to be risk-averse. So I guess what I'd really like to know is how to manage my... I mean, I naturally know that I have to let go sometimes, but it is hard, especially having spent so many years as a lawyer, which was probably the worst thing I did was getting out. Because I learned about everything that can go wrong.
Yeah. Good.
I'm fine with... Part of the nature of really good executives and really good CEO entrepreneurs is that they never ask themselves what if. They just go for whatever their wonderful idea is. And I've always found it interesting to try to get them to ask what if and still be in love with the goal that they're in love with. And so I'm interested in how you make that balance.
Good,
and
good.
The trade-off stuff.
We'll be talking about some of that.
Well, for me, you know, a lot of people talk about risk, especially now, enterprise risk management. But they're really, like Larry said, nobody's really doing anything in their mind or their head. They know, but they really don't. And we've been educating companies and executives for over 10 years, so, you know, I'm excited to hear more from the financial perspective. But it's always a reactive thing, not proactive. And we find a lot of executives look at it as a cost versus a revenue-generating activity. But it certainly, you can ask BP about how it could have saved them money and saved them from devastation if they had a risk management process in place that wasn't just talked about at the high level, but was actually implemented, you know, at a granular level right down to the, you know, individual employees. I'm very interested to hear your perspective.
Good.
Well, having an operational background, both manufacturing and marketing, and then going on to boards, we were constantly, especially at the board level, prioritizing our risks. And it was a major agenda item on the board agenda. So, I guess the area that I would concentrate on from a risk perspective is plan. And after you get done planning, keep planning and planning. And to your point, what is the contingency plan or the what-if scenarios? Because nothing is going to happen the way you think it's going to happen. You better have a backup plan. And the more you plan and more you have risk aversion, I think, you'll have a successful end product.
Sounds like your experience in the military forms some of your kind of perspective on risk.
I think it does for everybody.
Yes. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts with me. What's fascinating is that risk is involved. Risk is life. It's part of everything we do. And sometimes we recognize it, sometimes we don't. But the challenge is it's such a big subject. It's so multifaceted. There's so many elements to it that a lot of us have sat back and said, this is just, it's impossible to get a handle on, so why try? And there are just too many variables, too many things going on. It's just too complicated. And that's what really kind of drove me to do the research, to build some programs and actually end up writing the book I wrote about, because I was struck in the investment world I come from. I spent 30 years in the investment world as an advisor, and then I ended up having the good fortune to work at the headquarters of Payne Webber in New York and manage a lot of investment products and work with portfolio managers and deal with all kinds of market conditions. And what I was struck by was that how little investors understand risk, and in fact, how little most people understand risk. And my sense was that investors and the general public really need a lot of help in better understanding and managing risk, and the most likely folks to help them in the investment world would be financial advisors, but financial advisors don't really understand risk either. They tend to either oversimplify it, over-technicalize, bring on the technical overload, or use the don't ask, don't tell approach, which is, I think a lot of us as individuals do that as well, which is I'm not going to concern myself with risk unless it pops in front of me, and then I'll deal with it situationally, and then I'll, wait until something else happens. And what my sense was is that there's got to be a user-friendly, non-technical way to effectively manage risk. And in fact, I wrote an article in some industry publications about it as a call to action in the industry, and there was a lot of positive feedback on it, but nobody ever actually took any steps toward it. So I said, I guess I'm going to have to do it. So I'm going to share with you some of the insights I've learned about it, because risk doesn't have to be risk and risk management doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be highly technical. You don't need to have a PhD in math to really be an effective risk manager, which is, unfortunately, I believe, the tack a lot of major corporations are taking, because they're dealing with risk on a statistical basis rather than a practical, real-world basis. And what I'd like to do is share with you some of the insights. But first, I'd like to kind of set things up a little bit and get your mental juices going, I'd like to give you a quick quiz. This is a 15-second quiz. I'm going to pass this out, and please don't turn the paper over until I tell you to, because this is a timed quiz. And this quiz is going to teach you a little bit about yourself. There we go. And it's just a fun little short exercise. Pardon? See, you thought you guys could be able to relax and sit back, and I'm going to put you to work here. Okay, here we go. There you go. Okay, this quiz is called Count the F's. And when I tell you, it's time, I'd like you to flip this over, and there's a few lines of text. I'm going to ask you to count the number of F's you see in the lines of F's. And once you count it, then I'd like you to write the number of F's you counted down and then turn the paper over.
F as in Frank.
Pardon? F as in Frank, yes. Okay. Begin. Okay. Quiz over. So write the number of F's that you counted down. Okay, and just, you got a blank one? Excuse me. Sure. That didn't work. Yeah. Okay, everybody write the answers down. Okay. How many of you counted 3 F's? Okay. How many 4 F's? How many 5 F's? How many 6 F's? Okay. Interesting. There are actually 6 F's there. If you take a look at and read very carefully, you'll see that the F's and the of's, a lot of people don't count.
I
should have mentioned, you don't count the F at the top, because that makes it 7. If you counted them, I'll give you extra credit. Okay. Okay, and what, this is just an interesting little exercise. What's interesting is sometimes things can be right in front of us, but we can miss it. And in this particular case, it's because I think a lot of people read the text, and because the of's sound like a V, we don't count it. And risk management is the same way. Many times they're right in front of us. In fact, usually what you find is you look at risks after they've occurred, they seem obvious. Why didn't somebody get it? Just so straightforward. It's because a lot of times these things are right in front of us. But at the same time, it can be very simple. And being aware of these kinds of phenomena is really key to better understanding and managing risk. And in fact, the methodology that I'm promoting and encouraging people to follow is based on the fact that what we know about, what we thoroughly understand, and what we're fully prepared for, literally, with very few exceptions, can't hurt us. Because again, what we know about, what we really understand, and what we're prepared for can't hurt us. And that's really the history of the whole growth in the quality of our lives over the last 2,000 or 3,000 years. Because we took things that looked like magic or we didn't understand, we were afraid of, and we've actually, by knowing about them, understanding them, and preparing for, in terms of how to deal with them, we've actually converted them to working for us and improving the quality of our lives. Now, one other little exercise I'm going to ask you to do is, before we talk about my approach to risk, is I'd like you to take a risk quiz and test your own risk IQ. And we're going to take about maybe 5 minutes or so. This is a 10-question quiz, and so if you would take about 30 seconds on each question, this is kind of a top of the head kind of a reaction that you have. What are the first thoughts that come to your mind when you see these questions? And then we will go through them. And this is a self-graded quiz, so you don't need to worry about anyone reviewing your papers and seeing your answers. So you can be totally straightforward. So it'll take about 5 minutes, and I ask each one of you to take this quiz. There you go. Thank you. give me about another minute or so. And if you have any trouble with the question, just move to the next one. Try and get as many accomplished as you can. Okay, about 15 seconds and we'll wrap it up. I was going to say pencils down, but you're fast workers. Looks like you're all done. Before we get into the answers of this quiz, I'd like to ask a couple of questions. One, is the world getting more or less risky today? More? Same? Same? Less? You're all right. Because there are some, what's interesting, because the subject of risk is so broad, there are some risks. As we live with risks, we learn about risks, we understand risks, what happens is our ability to control and manage them, anticipate them, improves, and we can actually reduce the risks associated with it as we understand it. There's some risks that are staying the same because we're still trying to grapple with that understanding. And because of the speed of the change that's taking place in the world, we're seeing new risks that are coming on that we haven't ever dealt with before. And the question is, what is it that drives risk? What is it that generates risk and makes risk change and creates new risks? Any thoughts?
The unknown.
The unknown, and it's which is really the future, which is really rapid change. The more rapidly things change, the more risks you're going to see coming at you, the bigger risks that you see coming at you, but also the bigger opportunities, because risk and opportunity, or risk and reward, go together. And we live in the most rapidly changing period in human history. I mean, and it's not just technology, it's not just business or economics or ethics or any of those. It's everything at all levels. We've never seen anything like this before, and so that's driving uncertainty, it's driving change, and what that does is it creates opportunities and creates risks. Question is what's going to likely happen to the pace of change in the future? Think it's going to continue to accelerate? Is it going to moderate, or do you think it's going to actually go the other way? That's all it's done for 2,000 or 3,000 years, you know. Except what happened is we're moving to the exponential part of this of the curve now. And in fact, it's my thesis that we have crossed a watershed moment, a real inflection point, in that the old methods of dealing with risk, which we're dealing with them situationally or as they popped up, or dealing with them on a case-by-case basis, isn't going to work anymore, because the risks that are coming at us faster and bigger than ever before, and to have any chance of success in minimizing those risks, we've got to take a positive, proactive, direct approach to risk, and really have to institutionalize it into the way we run our lives, and in the way we run our businesses, and the way we run our portfolios. And so it's really key to sit down and look at positive, proactive risk management through knowledge, understanding, and preparation. And in fact, what's interesting is you look in the corporate world, 50 years ago, there was no such thing as the chief risk officer. Actually, the first chief risk officer named that was the chief risk officer at GE. I think he was appointed in 1995. Now you look at most major worldwide corporations, and they have a chief risk officer, new C-suite position, never been there before, who has responsibility for enterprise risk management and the resources to back it up. But the question I ask is as important it is and as valuable a function as, why are the corporations doing that? Why have they already suddenly increased this real focus on risk and risk management?
Yeah. Well, I think in the open world, risk is perceived as, whether it be casualty risk or fire risk or, and you can either insure it or self-insure it depending on the scale of your business. But what you're happening now is as change comes,
we used to call them torpedo stocks, and I think we still call them torpedo stocks in the portfolios, but now within businesses, they're torpedo businesses, okay, that, you know, if you sat down and said, yeah, would you go great, but what happens if we fail, all right, will it take the business down with us? All right, the concept of too big to fail is not an issue anymore. Like, GE is a perfect example. I mean, they were running guns and became a bank. And, you know, when banks were getting great valuations, they got a great valuation. But guess what happened? The bank failed.
Yes.
And it took, it basically blew up the stock.
Well, and you really hit on what's happened is that what's at stake has never been bigger. Companies, their assets, their purview, the businesses that they're in has never been broader, never been bigger. There's more at stake, and if you have a torpedo come in from out of nowhere and you're not ready for it, it can take down the whole edifice of the whole structure. We at BP or BU, an egg manufacturer in the Midwest, there are those things that are waiting out there, and what happens is it's absolutely much more expensive, much more difficult to recover from those risks to prevent it. The challenges from a business perspective and really from our own personal perspective is that what's the upside in avoiding a risk? There's really no upside. You'll get patted back, hey, great to see you avoided that risk. But it's usually you get nailed if the risk occurs, and if you avoid it, you get no credit whatsoever. I'm not sure how to address that issue. Maybe there's an opportunity to begin trying to get a hold of that and measure the risks you've avoided, but it's really one of the drivers, is that the reason a lot of people haven't focused on the past is because there was really no upside in avoiding it, and they were willing to take the risk of the boogeyman occurring. But now those things are just way, way too big. Yes.
Yeah, and even if you look at sort of standard management philosophy today, it's cut costs, cut costs, cut costs. The thing is, as you cut costs, there is some, and it needs to be measured, which is why you have risk officers, increase in risk. Because it may be that some of those costs were prevented. BP is the classic example. They, you know, cut costs, took the corner out. They're spending $1 billion on the well, and they're cutting costs by $10 to $15 million, and oh, by the way, now cost themselves $20 million. Okay.
Yeah, and unbelievable bad press and all the other, you know, stock valuation and everything.
A history of that in the company, which the new CEO was supposed to have solved that problem, but in fact, he was just as bad as the other.
Well, and it relates also to having a chief risk officer is a great initial step, and it shows a real commitment. But what's even more important to that is how is that integrated through the organization? Because whose job is risk management in an organization? It's everybody's job, and that's one of the real keys in an organization is making risk management a culture of the organization. But it doesn't have to be complicated, it doesn't have to be really technical, but it's just being sensitive to those risks and thinking them through, because with every upside, there's a downside. Yes?
I can't help but think that 25 years ago, total quality became the mantra, and we were all involved with totally immersing our companies in that. Is this the next wave?
I certainly think it is, and it's because it's been drawn to our attention. But my sense is that it's bigger than that, and that it's going to be a lasting kind of phenomenon, because my sense, at least, is with this rapid pace of change in the world, you're going to have to be proactive or you're going to be dead, because risks will literally kill you as an organization. And that the name of the game, in fact, in the investment world, I talk about it in my book, the name of the game in the investment world, for a lot of people, it's always been get higher returns. You know, go for the best performing the sector, the best performing stock, or the best performing company, or where the new opportunities are. But when you really look back at the foundation of risk management, what's the real foundation of risk management? It's the same thing that's the foundation of the medical profession. What's the core of the Hippocratic Oath? First, do no harm. And in the investment business, really, and in terms of your investing and your risk management, it should be risk management is number one. You know, first, don't lose, you know, because it's very difficult to recover from a loss. And granted, you can't be perfect all the time. Well, what it says is you want to spend at least as much time looking at the risks as you do the upside. A lot of folks don't look at both and don't make a balanced decision.
People mainly concentrate on financial risks, like stocks, bonds, blah, 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 that type of stuff.
Thank you for asking. The book itself is focused on the investment world, but the methodology can be used all everywhere, in business, in our personal lives. Because that's one of the things that struck me is in the investment world, our industry has adopted this quantitative approach to risk management, modern portfolio theory, for instance, and using all these quantitative methodologies. And those are elegant and beautiful mathematically, but what we've learned over the last 35 years is they're flawed. They don't work when you need risk management the most. All of a sudden, they fall apart. And we need to look at a better way. And my sense is, let me ask you, would you consider yourselves as individuals masters of risk management?
Okay, but I
would claim that you are. But you are masters of risk management. If you're an adult human being and you're walking around and you're reasonably healthy, that you have dealt with innumerable risks as a child, as you're growing up through your teens. I don't know, I have friends who didn't make it out of their teens because they were poor risk managers. They didn't make the right kinds of decisions. And what I see is that, think about just coming to our meeting this evening. You took some life-threatening risks coming here. I mean, literally, you could have died on the freeway, right? But what happens is, but you didn't. You were able to make it. Let me ask you, what's the process that you use to manage the risks coming over here this evening to be able to make it instead of being roadkill?
Isn't it all about risk tolerance?
We'll talk about that. Risk tolerance depends a lot on how you know and understand risk. Because if you know and understand things, you can be a lot more tolerant of it if you feel you have some control or a better understanding.
Can I interrupt just for a minute? One of our risks is at 6 o'clock we're going to get thrown out.
Okay. So, okay, let me...
Do you want to leave?
Will,
yeah.
Oh, we will. Oh, can we go outside?
Oh, yeah, we can go outside.
Okay.
Go outside.
But let me... I think we'll cover some of these things through the quiz. Number one, the first question I ask is, what's your definition of risk? Very good. Any other thoughts on that?
The probability of a negative outcome.
Yeah, negative.
Okay.
Does risk have to be negative?
No, actually it doesn't. That's very good. Risk can be positive. Okay, all good answers. What I find is when I ask most investor conferences, what I do when I ask investors that, they say it's risk of loss. The ones that are technically oriented, they say it's standard deviation, or it's missing a benchmark, or it's a volatility risk that things are going all over. But my sense is those aren't risks; those are really the results of risks. And if you're trying to deal with those kinds of things and manage those, it's like a doctor trying to treat symptoms. And again, getting back to the doctor analogy, what's one of the first things first-year medical students are taught? Don't treat the symptom, treat the cause. Look for what's causing that and then treat that. Otherwise, you're never going to cure the disease. So,
a function of your capabilities so that I would if there are situations where your capacity is less than the demanded skill, because isn't risk really a function of what you do and don't know?
Absolutely. Knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know is really important to risk management. But what I point out this is the fundamental thing that you need to do when you're looking at understanding and managing risk is, number one, define what risk is. And I've frankly been very unsatisfied with the definitions I found in the investment business, whether it's standard deviation or volatility or whatever. And the best definition I've found for for risk is actually comes from the chief risk officer, now the chief financial officer at Apple Computer. His name is Peter Oppenheimer. And he said something very similar to what you said. He said, risk is the degree to which your outcome varies from what you expected. And I found that
either
up or down. Actually, I don't know if you've ever had the experience. I've worked for a firm that was too successful with a new product. We rolled out a new product, and we priced it to be the low-cost of alternative in the marketplace, and we ended up getting so much business, we couldn't process it, and all the business we're getting, not only could we not process it, we were losing money on every piece of business. And it was just a nightmare, but we were successful because we didn't know, we weren't planning for that level of success. And so you can have too much positive, you can have positive risk and negative risk. But that what I would encourage you to do is look for a definition of risk. This is the best I found, but if you find one better, I'd love to hear it. But what my sense is you want a definition of risk that's empowering. And that's empowering because we have a lot of control of what we think of the range of expectations. And where we really get nailed is when something happens we didn't expect. A la BP. Right? They didn't think that could happen, but it did. And those are the ones where you can really get nailed. A big question. In the investment world, there's a lot of talk about risk and reward are always equally balanced. To get greater returns, you got to get greater risk. Is that true or not? Not only just investments overall. No, it's not. Actually, risk and reward don't have to be equally balanced. You can tilt the risk reward in your favor through knowledge, understanding, and preparation. I'll give you an example. Richard Branson, I saw an interview with him recently, and this gentleman was asking him, he said, gee, you know, you're viewed kind of as a guy who's really out there, really taking risks, always super aggressive, you know, shooting into space, all kinds of stuff. Would you consider that an accurate assessment of you? He said, oh, not at all. He said, I like to take risks but control the risk. He said, for example, when I was going to start up Virgin Airlines, he said, I wasn't sure if it was going to work or not. So I called up the chairman or the people at Boeing to buy some airplanes, and he said they didn't believe I wanted to buy airplanes. He said, wait a second, you know, Virgin Records, the Rolling Stones, those things, you want to buy airplanes? What's going on here? But he said he wanted to buy some airplanes from them, but he wanted to structure the deal so that Boeing would buy them back in a year if he didn't want them. He wanted to limit his risk on owning the planes. And he said, we cut a deal. Yeah, I paid a little more than I would have if I just bought them outright, but I knew that if the airline didn't work, I didn't have the, you know, airplane sitting in my back in my backyard after it paid for it.
Because the great sub AIG, but you know, it's the International Lease Finance. The reason we got a whole bevy of startup airlines is because International Lease Finance was willing to lease them a plane and take it back if the business went bust. They were willing to assume that risk.
Mm-hmm. But so it's risk and reward the risk reward ratio or balance can be shifted through knowledge, understanding, and preparation and kind of anticipating the risk in advance. What are the three basic types or states of risk?
You mean like market, political, and company risk from an individual company?
Actually, I'm even looking at kind of a higher level. When you look at the broad category of risks across a business, personal, investments, everything. Any thoughts? Okay. Let me run through them. Number one, and these are not mine. These are actually from Benoit Mandelbrot, who's a professor at Yale. Number one is mild risk. Mild risk has no big surprises. It's low variability. It's normal bell curve distribution. It's statistically based. Modern finance theory assumes only that kind of risk. In fact, what's interesting is Mandelbrot was doing some studies and trying to look at the at risk and how it's a big kind of amorphous animal that's hard to describe. And he all of a sudden realized that risk is a lot like the states of matter in the universe. You know, in the universe, what are the three states of matter? It's liquids, solids, and gases, right? And you take something like water. Water is, as a solid, is ice. And it has very different physical properties than water as a liquid, which has very different physical properties than steam, right? But it's all water, the same thing. He said risk is the same way. There's mild risk, which is this no big surprise, low variability, normal bell curve distribution type of risk. There's wild risk, which is irregular, unpredictable, outside the norm, limitless, frightening, fluid from one value to the next. It's, for instance, if you look in the stock market, price changes in Dow Jones Industrial Average from 1916 to 2008, which is 2003, which is 88 years. Bell curve theory predicts that you'd have days of greater than 3.4% daily move in the market 58 days out of a 22,000 days. In reality, instead of 58 days, we had over 1,000. Bell curve theory says that we should see moves of greater than 7% once every 300,000 years. We've seen 48. Bell curve theory says that you should see a drop like we saw October 19th in 1987. Of 21% in one day, you usually see that 1 to the 1050th days, which basically says it should never happen, but it happened. So wild risk is a real phenomenon that happens. And then there's what he calls slow risk, which is slow, hard to identify, build slowly over time, why we need things like maintenance to keep things going, and we need to put energy in the systems because of entropy. It's like an earthquake. It just builds over time, and then it cracks. And what happens is those are the three kinds of risks. But what tends to happen is when you look at a risk that way, that they're mild risks, they're wild risks, and they're slow risks, it actually makes it easier to understand them and to manage them.
Again, investment risk and why the stock market does the crazy things it does. If the stock market, and you see it in commodities, in the commodity market, your longs equal your shorts. So you tend to have trends, but you don't see huge drops because the longs equal the shorts. In the stock market, the longs are 95%, shorts are 5%. By definition, if the market starts going down, bids dry up and liquidity goes to zero.
But
assumption in all the economic models is that there's perfect liquidity.
But
there's an endowed market, there's no liquidity.
Yeah, but there's also wild risk in everything.
Right.
What you have to do is you have to understand there's mild risk and wild risk as well. What are the two basic approaches or schools of risk management? Well, just to save some time, what I see is there are two. There's the quantitative approach, which is, again, using essentially using the past as a reference and quantifying and looking at all those relationships and projecting that in the future, saying that the past and all those relationships are the best read of what's going to happen in the future. And let me ask you, in the fastest changing period in human history, how valuable do you think it is to quantify the past and project that in the future? My sense is there's a weak spot there. The qualitative or subjective school of risk management is the other. And the subjective school is based on making subjective judgments about a subjective future and using some of your insight and intuition and experience in terms of looking at what are the ranges of possibilities. Which one of those is best?
It's the classic argument between the fundamentalists.
Yes,
and the technical.
Absolutely. My sense is they're both good, but you have to understand their strengths and their weaknesses. And in fact, if you use both in complement, understanding the strengths and the weaknesses of each, and using both, you can actually end up with a better result. Yes.
6 o'clock. I'd like to encourage us to continue this conversation out there because
okay.
Tatum Financial Partners is using this room.
Okay.
Here, so
should we just break out there?
We can convene.
Would you like to go to the...
Okay.
Okay.
Any of you want to leave at 6? Thank you, Tony. See you out there.
I
didn't know that Tatum had this.
That's fine. No trouble.
So, but
and we're all always paid to be flexible.
That's
correct. That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you much. Yes, let me get that book too. Look forward to reading that. That's good.
I'd wait till the movie comes out.
George Clooney's good.
Oh, wow. That'll be fun. You get to go to the premiere, too, right?
Excuse me.
Did you stay out here in the cafeteria?
I don't know where.
We'll be out here. Oh, good.
Yeah.
Super. There we go. Place to be flexible when you run into a risk, right?
If you look at the great crashes,
mm-hmm.
It's all because the quant thought they had everything under control. I mean, the 87 crash was because the concept of portfolio insurance. People forgot to sell.
Well, that was
because you didn't sell more, Dixie, you know, you're in
the... Well, what's interesting is you go look back even in 1907 or back in the 1800s, even before quants were around, you saw the same kind of phenomena.
In all cases, liquidity dried up and people froze.
And that's because there's the psychological aspects to the market.
In 1907, which they pulled the tax on the exchange-traded stocks. That's what you do.
Well, JP. He basically wouldn't let the bankers out of his office.
Yeah.
JP
Morgan is a real realtor.
Yep. We got this off here.
Excuse me. Let me drop this off. Sure.
I mean, where'd you like the microphone, Larry?
Oh, thank you.
Great. Thanks very much.
How was there?